Blog Talk Radio.
Edition, June 27th, 2015. We want to thank you all, however, wherever, and whenever you listen to the show. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Of course, this is our last show. We are taking a month off for July, like we pretty much do every summer while we go to Thriller Fest, and now we're going to the PNWA. So we kind of have a month-long thing. We're doing a lot of interviews at Thriller Fest. You're going to be able to hear Joseph Fender, Sandra Brown. I have lined up Peter James, John Land, along with Scott Chereau. So all those we're going to be interviewing at Thriller Fest. We're going to tape them. We're going to record them. We'll play them on the air during shows. So make sure you listen to that. Go to suspenseradionetwork.com for more information on this show and all the shows, which is Crime and Science Radio, Story Blender, and Beyond the Cover. And so this today, 60 Minutes, we have two fantastic authors. We're going to kick it off with author Chris Carlson, followed by then with Robert Cadera. So let's just jump in right now. Author Chris Carlson, she wrote a book called Silk. It's a fantastic novel. It's historical fiction. If you go to her website, which is chriscarlson.com, K-A-R-L-S-E-N, you're going to notice the first thing is there's going to be a lot of historical romance. History is definitely something that comes into the book Silk. And so let's get Chris right now on the air. Chris, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and thank you for inviting me today. Yeah, so
thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, history plays a part in every book of mine. I have two that are romantic thrillers, two that are set in Turkey that are nautical archaeology. They involve artifact smuggling and that sort of thing. But my father taught history, so history was a topic that was just a constant in our house.
From reading your bio, you were predestined to write historical fiction because your father was a history teacher, your mother was an avid reader. Put the two together, and what do you get? A historical fiction writer.
Yes, yes.
So, like I said, Silk is definitely historical fiction. It takes you back to a time with Jack the Ripper, so 1888, and during all that time that's going on with his reign. However, you threw a little caveat in there because while he's doing what he's doing, your detective, which is Rudyard Bloodstone, has something else that he has to contend with, and that's another serial killer going along the same parallel. So there's a lot of rampage going on in London. So give us the behind-the-scenes look into Silk and, you know, Bloodstone, the character, and everything that you got going on within it.
Well, Rudyard is, I've always loved the movie Zulu. So I was in Wales, and I wanted to visit the Regimental Museum of the men that fought at the two of the biggest battles in the Zulu Wars. And one of them was Rorke's Drift, and Rorke's Drift had 11 Victoria Crosses were awarded to the men of that. It was an incredible battle. And then they gave me a private tour, and I said, someday, if I'm going to write a character, and I'm going to make him a veteran of that battle. And that's what Rudyard is Welsh, but he lives in London now. He did 9 years in the military. He was wounded at Rorke's Drift. And he was one of the characters that, he's a character, the minute I sat down, I knew everything there was to know about him. I just knew him inside and out when I went to write him. And he was so much fun because I could do a lot with him because I had him in Victorian London. So I could see London. I wanted to show London through the eyes of a man of the period, a man of the time, and not make judgment. I tried not to make judgmental writer judgment or with modern eyes on it. I tried to set it, this is him, this is the world he lives in. And I think that London being, you know, you think of Victorian London, it's foggy, it's got little cobblestone streets, and, you know, and it's dark, and, you know, you just have the gas lamps and stuff, and it has just a lot of natural atmosphere. So, Rudyard was fun because I had a lot of fun making his associates, giving him the different people in it that came in and out of his life. You know, whether it's his partner and his partner's wife, who Rudyard's single, and she would like to see him. You know, she would like to see him with a lady.
Right.
Rudyard's like always kind of trying to dodge that bullet, you know, with her. And I tried to show the politics a little of the time, because it was such a disparity between the poor of London and the very wealthy, and the lack of regard for the poor, you know, by some of the wealthy until Jack the Ripper, when they were forced to look at what was going on in the East End. And it was interesting to write because I'm a retired police detective, and
right.
In 1888 was 2 years before they really started even doing anything with fingerprints. So everything that Rudyard had to do, it had to be just truly old-fashioned police work, no science involved. The only thing I did science-y, which was, and I took a little bit of license time-wise with it, was that he photographed the crime scenes. He had them photographed. But so I kind of had to go back and be an old-fashioned detective and walk the scene with him. Like, okay, what am I going to put in here that he can pick up on? What is he not going to pick up on? That sort of thing. It was interesting as a retired police officer to go back to the bare bones of investigation.
Now, the thing that I find fascinating is that for so many years you wrote so much historical romance, and now you dive straight into writing, Detective Inspector, which is a little bit more, like you just said, up your alley at being a retired detective. So the question is, what took you so long?
You know, I'm writing right now. I'm writing my book four of my historical romances. Those are fun. They involve knights. They involve men that fought in this one battle. So everything that happens in this series happens from that battle. And I love them. I love writing the knights. It's just I wanted to do something different. And Rudyard was just, I don't know, he just kind of was hanging in the back of my mind, this character. And everybody kept asking me, well, are you going to do a cop story? And I said, I don't want to do a modern-day cop story. And I love reading good ones. I love Mike Connelly. I love John Sanford and Joe Rombaugh. But I don't want to rewrite my career. So I could write a historical cop. That interested me.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, I just wanted to break away, do something a little fresh and different, and I just had so much fun with him that I know I'm going to make him a series.
Now, the one thing, of course, is that you see a lot of women authors who, you know, start off writing, you know, romance and then getting themselves into writing more thrillers, Sandra Brown and, you know, Nora Roberts and those types. I mean, Patricia Cornwell might have been one of the only ones who really didn't start out writing romance. She kind of jumped right in. But you kind of see that progression. Do you think that that progression is something that needs to happen to kind of show people in a dominant filled genre that, hey, you know what, us women, we can write very thrilling, scary books, but they kind of have to get their feet wet and writing maybe something a little bit and just building up to that process? It always fascinated me why it took like that process in order to get there. Was that kind of the same journey you decided to take, or did it just happen a different way?
I think with the women that you named, like whether it's Julia Garwood or Nora Roberts or Sandra Brown and them, I think that they came up during a time when New York publishing houses had a much narrower view of female authors. And they didn't want to see a brand new female author in the suspense mystery world. They just I think they were closed-minded about it. This is just my opinion. And all those women established themselves first. You know, and finally after they established themselves, they got to write in another genre. But even in the early days, a lot of them had to write with a different name because the house said, "Oh, no. Nora Roberts is J.D. Robb." You know, and You know, and now I think New York's kind of had to bend and be a little more flexible because these women have been successful in more than one genre. And, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I guess women can write suspense. Well, yeah, you got Tess Garrison, you got a whole lot of people out there that,
yeah,
women know how
and
to scare people.
And she started out writing
too.
Romance, too. That's
yeah, they're
But
I just think, and
back.
Now there's, pardon?
The funny thing is that they started writing romance, but then once they got into the thriller genre and they started going, they've never gone back to the romance. So it was almost like they had to cross that bridge to get where they really wanted to go, and then they've really never looked back. Besides Nora Roberts, one that does. She writes under Nora and J.D. Robb, so she kind of still does both. But a lot of them never really looked back. They never really did
Garwood.
It that way. So I was,
Garwood is not. She's gone back
Julie,
and forth.
Julie Garwood does, yep.
But
yeah.
For me, it wasn't. For me, I'm with a small publisher and who gives me a lot of freedom, and I just wanted to dabble in different genres and whatever. If something interests me, if a character or an event catches or a historical period catches my interest, I want to do a story about it. And to me, the story. I don't think about it as like, oh, I'm going to write this genre now. I just think about, I just want to write this story, and it fits wherever it fits as I tell it, you know?
Mm-hmm. So it sounded like your character, and let me remind everybody here first again that we're speaking with author Chris Carlson. Go to chriscarlson.com, K-A-R-L-S-E-N, for more information on the book Silk that we're talking about, along with the other series that she writes in the romantic, historical romantical field. So when you were thinking of it, it sounds like that you thought of your character first, that you kind of said, like you said, you had Bloodstone kind of sitting in the back of your head. So were you then just waiting for the right story to come along to fit him in, or did you think of this story and then you thought of him and said, okay, now the two are going to be married together? There you go.
Well, this was a funny coming together, and I people laugh when I tell them, but I
okay.
had been – one of my favorite movies is Phantom of the Opera with Gerard Butler, you know. I mean, it kills me, slays me to see it. So I was between books, and I was on to some downtime, and I put the movie on, and I thought to myself, you know, I wonder if I could ever write I thought it was remarkable that Andrew Lloyd Webber gave you this really very terrible person, but every woman in it, when every woman that saw the movie cried for him, you know. I said, he managed to make this very empathetic killer. And
mm-hmm.
as a police officer, I thought, well, that's kind of a challenge. And I sat down and I started writing the killer. And I realized I can't. I'm sorry. I've just seen with my career being what it was. I just can't make you. I have no sympathy or empathy for you. I can't make you. I can't make you. You know, Gerard Butler. I can't make you this lovable character at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, and then I had this. I said, you know, my Zulu war veteran. I said he would be a perfect foil for this. But I liked what I had of the villain, of the killer. So this was like it just came. You know, it just occurred to me like finally this is my this is where I'm going to make Rudyard. This is where I'm putting you. And I plugged him in, and then it was just the whole book is two different POVs. I go back and forth between the killer's POV. Point of view and Rudyard's. So you see both of them as they progress through the story and what they're thinking and what's motivating. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So
like
that,
it, yeah.
The characters came to me before the story did.
Gotcha. And they just kind of, and you know, and like any other author, they keep coming back, don't they? It's like if you don't put them down on paper, they keep coming into your nightmares, they keep coming, popping up and into your stuff until eventually you eventually write them, and then they're like, okay, now I'm alive. So it kind of takes that time before you finally get it on paper, almost to kind of get them out of your head for a time being. You say, okay, leave me alone. Now here's your own story. Now go have fun.
You know, I did that with my in my very first book. His the knight in that has a friend, his best friend, and his friend I loved his friend was just so fun, and he was another one I finally had to say, you know what, you're getting too, I'm not going to give you all this page time, you're not the hero, I will give you a book when I'm done with this book. And it was like, yeah, you got to tell that character, back up now, I'll give you a book, just
right,
calm down. But it is funny. You do get characters, and every writer I know says you get characters, they just like lean over your shoulder and go, hey, hey, hey.
Yeah, I'm still here, and I'm still waiting for you to get to freaking work on my stuff, you know. But now, when you look at the book Silk, and you say, of course, you know, you have his partner, is there another character that is kind of had a bigger voice than you thought they were going to have when you started writing the book? Someone who kind of surprised you, kind of popped out, that you were like, wow, you know, this is kind of cool. I had no idea that this character would be, you know, so... you know, so popular in my head.
Not so much. Maybe a little bit in that there were characters that I knew once I saw them on the page, I knew they were going to come back. He's got another detective from the City of London Police Department, which was entirely different. He's London Metropolitan Police, and then there's the City of London, which they just do that one square mile around Buckingham Palace and all that. They're very kind of upper she kind of, you know, police department.
Mm-hmm.
And they think they're very elite because they've got the palace. And there's a detective that works there that they hate each other. And I knew the guy's name is Nathaniel Napier. And, you know, and more than once, you know, there's one point in the book where Napier says something to him. He says, you know, and Rudyard finally says, you know what? Because Rudyard's kind of a rough and tumble character. You know, his father was a blacksmith. He's not a, you know, he came from a pretty lower income background. So he's a scrapper. And he turns around, he says, you want to have a go at me, Napier? Come on, let's go. Let's do it. And I just knew, I knew Napier. I said, Napier is going to be a pain in your rear end, Rudyard, in the next book too. And maybe the book after that. You know, he's one of those characters that, yeah, there's going to be this constant issue with these two guys. And then his boss is kind of funny because he's a little unpredictable. So, you know, and he's a little unpredictable, and he's... And the superintendent, and he likes, you know, every once in a while when things are going really bad, you know, with the press and everything, he, you know, you'll see him like have a drink in the middle of the day or look wistfully at his bottle of whiskey and kind of go, oh my God, you know. So
yeah, and that's kind of fun to explore too, isn't it? It's always neat when those things do happen.
Yeah, because I. Yeah, you can really do you can do a lot with the support characters, you know. Mm-hmm. They can do a lot of stuff. They can get away with things that
right.
you can't always get away with the protagonist, you know.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's good when you're able to explore that side, because it's not every story, I think, when you first get into it, and I could be wrong, is it. Is it challenging for you, or does sometimes you get bored, you know, yourself when you're starting to write, and you kind of need that little jolt to get going to do something else?
Yeah, I tend to, there's times I sit back and I look at it and I have to try and think, like, where can I, you know, give this a shot in the arm? I've got a scene, I've got one of the main characters in this thing. I know that I have to do something either bad or good to him or her,
mm-hmm.
and that's when it's best for me to bring in one of the support characters, because I can have them just come out of nowhere with an off the wall suggestion or something, or have them do something that, you know, it wasn't so obvious. It wasn't so obvious that I just dropped it in and had the protagonist do it because I couldn't think of anything else. No, they. I can have them react to something, you know. Mm. So that's where they're really helpful, your support characters, for me.
Yeah. Well, now, we talked a little off the air, and so, you know what, I think this might be a good time that you might read a little excerpt from the book. Do you have that handy?
I do.
We got about six or seven minutes left. Is that enough time?
Yeah. It's just, this is only about probably 60 seconds or 90 seconds.
Oh yeah, that's good. So why don't you read a little bit of the excerpt? So then maybe we can so it might, you know, spawn some other things about you know, the book and this and that. So why don't you go ahead, and what part of the book is this that you're going to read? Is it the beginning, or is it a scene?
This is fairly early on. He's sitting in a pub. His friend is a veteran. One of his veteran friends from the Crimean War is the owner of the pub, and he's sitting there having a drink with him, and he's thinking, you know, the pub owner's name is Morris. Anyway, so Morris is like comes up to him, and he's sitting there as Rudyard's sitting at the table. And so this is part of that, from that excerpt from that chapter.
Great.
Events of the day and the potential satisfaction of giving Napier a bloody nose dwindled. Questions about the murder crept back into Ruddy's thoughts. Morris joined him at his table in the rear of the pub with a Guinness, the popular beer of choice, in hand. You've got the look of a man whose thoughts are a long distance from London. That's Morris speaking. No, sadly my thoughts are fixed here in the city. I'm trying to figure out a clue. Ellis's roommate said she'd sometimes meet with a well-dressed man, a man of means, the victim indicated. They'd meet up at the fountain by the British Museum. Don't know the spot, but then the museum isn't my cup of tea. Not the point. I'm saying it's odd. What member of upper class chooses to stroll through a public garden other than Hyde or Regent's Park, where they can be seen and be seen? You know, yes, I'm sorry, where they can see and be seen by one of their own.
Mm-hmm.
I agree the wealthy prefer the parks filled with others of their kind, but it doesn't mean a man can't enjoy someplace different. We interviewed the guard again. The one that discovered the body walks that half of the building. He told us majority of their male patrons are natty dressers, but he never saw a man like that loitering by the fountain. My guess is the man is married and can't afford to run the risk of being seen by a friend or of his wife's, or he might live and work in the area and the spot is convenient. Or, this is Ruddy, he's a murderer who's noticed the victim walking through the park on a regular basis, saw it as an opportunity, and cozied up to her. Rudyard took another swallow of his ale, mentally debating the merit of each theory. I don't think he lives in the area. If so, he'd have cut through the park more and been seen by the guards. Not sure about the married man having a tryst idea. To Ruddy's way of thinking, if a man was married and looking for a tumble, he'd have met her someplace other than the gardens and at a better hour. Instinct drew him back to the original sense of the culprit and crime. I feel like this was a crime of opportunity. I've thought it all along and can't shake the sense. If he was just seeking a victim, then why haven't you more murders like this? Morris asked. Ruddy downed the rest of his beer and put his tankard on the edge of the table where June would refill it. Everyone has to start somewhere. She might be number one. And that's that little section. I kind of stumbled over a little bit. I'm not a very good actress, apparently.
That's all right. Kind of got the idea. And the one thing that you kind of got is you definitely knew the period about which writing. You definitely knew that this was something that was not modern, set back in that Victorian age. You got the sense of, you know, how things are going to do. And like I've always said 100 times, I've said 100 times on my radio show, and I'll say it again, I love the stories where the detectives have to be detectives. I don't like it where technology comes and they get a text message with a picture, and it's like, oh, here's the guy's fingerprint. Oh, here's the guy's DNA. And there's really nothing to do because it's all science-based, and now it's just a matter of maybe finding the person or there's a shootout. But I like it when detectives were detectives. I'm an Agatha Christie fan. I'm a Sherlock Holmes fan. You know, I'm those types of fans, and that's the type of book that you've written. Detectives have to be detectives. They're not just, you know, messengers of information anymore.
Yeah. What I enjoyed about him, or even what I enjoy about, like, Connolly does as well with his Harry Bosch, is they're not always 110% sure of everything. You know, they have to, like you said, you have to be a detective, but there are times they question. Like, if something just doesn't feel right to them and they can't put their finger on it, and all the science in the world isn't going to help them, you know. They've got to figure something out on their own. What's wrong with this? What's wrong with the picture that's being painted for me, you know?
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that is, like I said, when you have more of the modern detective stories now, it seems like the writer defaults to forensics and CSI stuff way too often than defaulting to the detective and doing detective work. And I think that's why I get a little bit bored with some of the new detective novels and things that are out, because they do default too much to the science part of it, and they get away from the human interaction part of it. And I think that's why I like the, you know, the Hercule Poirot's. When you watch the Poirot series, you know, he's talking to every individual person to figure out and putting all these pieces and parts together to make them fit in the puzzle. Where in today's day and age, like I said, they find a piece of DNA, and then they find who it is, and now they just have to go find that person. And so I just kind of find it a little bit, I kind of a little bit copped out, I guess. I don't know. That's just me. But I'm crazy, and people know I am, so.
No, I understand that, and it's probably one of the reasons there's only a couple cop shows that we watch, because my husband's a retired detective too, because some of them are just it's just a kind of a little over the top. But you know, one of the ones that we like, that we really loved, and you speak of Hercule Poirot, is Foyle's War. It was a BBC show.
Oh yeah,
and he's like that. Too. He doesn't have the forensics really, because it's World War II. But that interaction that he has with, you know, just trying to put into just one piece of the puzzle at a time, you know.
Yeah.
And he's just very patient.
Well,
and,
yep, I get you. And we got about 30 seconds left, and so I don't want to miss out. I want you to let everybody know, kind of give you the last word of, you know, finding all your social media, all your stuff, and everything else. So I'm going to leave it to you.
Okay. If you go to chriscarlson.com, and that is chriscarlson.com, I will have excerpts and samples from every book I have. I also have trailers, and I've had on the trailer for Silk. I'm really happy with it, and I think a lot of your listeners would be interested in seeing it.
It's cool.
I have a Pinterest page where I have my book boards, which are my Dreamcast, where you can use celebrity pictures and say, this is how I pictured Rudyard, and this is how I pictured so and so. And I have a Facebook page, you know, Chris Carlson. I'm on there, and I'm trying to think, but I'm not on Twitter. I can't wrap my head around that, so don't do it. But those are the best places to see me. I am part of a newsletter, and if you email me at chriscarlsonwriter@gmail.com, if you're interested in the newsletter, I share a newsletter with four other authors where we all write different things. And it's free. We send it via email, and I think that you might have fun with that one. It gives you a little sample of what everybody's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
that Fabulous Five thing that's on your website, I thought.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute joy to hear you and speak with you about your book. So talking about a subject matter that's very close to me, because I'm a huge Jack the Ripper fan, and I like to devour things from that time and that period. So thank you so much for coming on, and I wish you nothing but the best. And you know what? Get out of the historical romance stuff and start writing more of the other fiction stuff. But I know the historical romance stuff pays the bills. So you got to pay the bills, I understand. But, you know, you can still do some other things too, you know. So.
Well, I'll be doing a sequel to Silk. I'll start that probably the end of the year, and it'll probably be out by early next year in spring.
Awesome. Again, thank you so much for coming on, and we know nothing but the best, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay, thank you for having me.
All right,
bye-bye.
Bye. So again, everybody, that is author Chris Carlson. Check it out, chriscarlson.com, for more information on the book Silk. We also have to tell you about another book that we've been talking about all summer long, because the radio show this month has been sponsored by none other than New American Library, and they're the publisher of the most provocative thriller of the year called Eeny Meeny by M.J. Arledge. Lisa Gardner calls it mesmerizing, and Tammy Hogue says it's white knuckles guaranteed, and that is now on sale wherever books are sold. So go out there and support our sponsors. Got some more coming up for you. We're going to take a little quick break, and then we will be back right after this with our next guest, Robert Cadera, and his book, Red Gold. So here you go.
Hello, everybody, and I'd like to talk to you about some upcoming releases that are out now. Arthur Barbara Petty delivers the first book in a new series called What Has Mother Done? The title itself suggests a riveting mystery wrapped up within a drama. Reviewers have agreed that Barbara penned a winner, so check out Amazon.com for more on What Has Mother Done by Barbara Petty. Five gripping new mysteries await you from publisher Camel Press: Stealing the Golden Dream, Due for Discard, and Split to Splinters are just a few of the wonderful books being published by Camel Press. Check out all their titles by visiting camelpress.com. The Thriller Master is back with a sequel. Yes, David Morrell releases Inspector of the Dead, which brings back character Thomas DeQuincey. Murder as a Fine Art was the first book and was listed on several of the top lists in 2014. Now experience more of 1850s London and Inspector of the Dead. Go to davidmorrell.net for more information on these and all of his books. Kensington Kills. Well, not really, but their books sure do. And author Lisa Jackson, and M. William Phelps, A.J. Tana, and more deliver explosive action and intrigue with every page. Make sure you visit KensingtonBooks.com for more information on these and every title they have to offer, and you won't be sorry. Suspense Theater comes alive with Amon Kabachnik. His Blood on the Stage books bring readers a wealth of material for lovers of the stage, says the Los Angeles Times. Check out Where Stories Come Alive and visit Amon Kabachnik for more information on all six of these titles. And that's AmonKabachnik.com. A Century-Old Tale Leads to a Fortune in Bandit Gold. That's the adventure that Jack Farrell faces in his latest adventure, Murrayana Gold, by author William Nickel. This is the fourth book in the series. And visit William Nickel, that's two K's, EL.com for more information on this and the entire series.
All right, everybody, welcome back. And for you fans of 80s movies, if this was a YouTube video, I would do my best Phoebe Cates in, what the hell is the word I'm trying to think of? I can't even think of it. You would see me doing that on Fast Times at Ridgemont High because that's the song that was playing during that famous part of the movie. Impersonation, that's the freaking word I was thinking of. But we're going to get right in here now to our next author. His name is Robert Cadero, the author of Red Gold, his debut series. With Gabe McKenna as the lead character. So, Robert, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Thanks, John. I'm doing fine. It's nice to talk to you.
And you know what? We finally we met you not too long ago when you were out here for Sisters in Crimes in L.A. doing that convention. And now
that's
it was
right.
Great to be able to get you on to talk about Red Gold. I will say, you know, for disclaimer and everything, that Red Gold is a book that Suspense Publishing has published. So it's great to get you on and talk with you. Just so everybody knows all that. So, Gabe McKenna is your lead character. Red Gold, your debut book. Tell us about it.
Well, okay. I guess we got to start with Gabe because he's the center of the entire series. He's a retired, self-imposed retired history professor from New York who's recently widowed, and he's a guy who. His life is really on the skids. The story of Red Gold is a mystery. It's a little bit of historical fiction. It's got some romance. It's got lots of booze. And it's a story of a man's personal redemption. And Gabe is New York streetwise, but he's also a well-educated guy. So he's got the brains and he's got the brawn, former Golden Gloves amateur boxer, so he doesn't shy away from a scrap when danger presents itself. So Red mm-hmm. Gold is the story of him in the depths, getting a mysterious letter from an unexpected letter from New Mexico, saying that he'd inherited an estate of a distant relative he hadn't seen in about 25-30 years. Basically, just to get out of New York and breathe some fresh air, he comes to New Mexico. And to his surprise, finds out that he's suddenly a wealthy man, but he's inherited a little bit more than money He also finds himself in the midst of a very deadly, life-threatening struggle over a lost 19th century gold called the Lost Adams Gold. Some of you might remember a movie called McKenna's Gold, which starred Gregory Peck about 40 years ago. The story of Red Gold is Gabe stumbling into this and then really having to recover and put himself back together as a human being in order to not only find the gold but learn the true value of it.
And the book is set in New Mexico, where you're from, so it's very close to your home. And
right.
Why is that one of the reasons why you decided? I mean, because, you know, people always say write what you know and write about the area that you know. So was it just predetermined that when you were going to write your first thriller book that this is where you were going to start with and you were going to kind of start in this area?
No, John, this thing, the book really came together kind of on its own. I went along for the ride. I dreamed up the character of Gabe McKenna before I knew about the film McKenna's Gold, before I knew about the Lost Adams Gold. I placed him in New Mexico. I'm a transplanted New Yorker here myself and a former history teacher. And so he's close to me. But New Mexico is such an incredible place, so culturally varied. As a historian, I'm intrigued by the five centuries of history, especially since European settlement here. And so it's the richness of New Mexico that I wanted to bring out in the series. And each of the books in the series will be centered here. And Gabe will have to, unlike other sleuths, he uses his knowledge of history to help solve the puzzle, so to speak.
So Gabe was kind of running around in your head before you decided that this was going to be something that you were going to do.
Yes, he's well. Let me back up a second, John. And when I retired from a long career in teaching, and there were two things in my life that I really wanted to do as a young man. One was to play Major League Baseball, and the other was to write novels. And by the time I retired, that first dream was out of the question. So I had intended all along to write as soon as the opportunity presented itself, and you know the kids were grown and out of the house and had their own families and so on. When I moved out here to New Mexico, the land and the history of it also, I think, played a role in fashioning the direction, in determining the direction I took when I started to write. You can't live here, and you can't live in New Mexico without being really deeply affected by the land and just the visuals, the people, and I had to put him here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, and he kind of fits, you know, within the realm that you've done. I mean, that's the only possible place that he probably could have been.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And and you know, it's I heard it told to me years back that in a lot of ways the most important character in your book is the setting, and so here I have a professor. Gabe is a professor of pre-Columbian history and antiquities. He's also kind of an anthropologist and archaeologist. So New Mexico was the ideal spot to situate him in. And then I studied up on a lot of the history of New Mexico and some of the unsolved mysteries of its history. And I hope to bring some of that into each of the books that I write.
Gotcha. And speaking of writing, you kind of, or speaking of your books here, because, you know, now we know this is going to be a series, but you kind of took it took a little while, I guess, you know, because I know a little bit of your backstory. You know, you had writing groups and this and that before it finally came out.
Yes.
So how long, you know, for new authors that think, oh, I can sit down in 6 months, just whip out a book and write it out there and
mm-hmm.
get it on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them kind of about your journey on what you had to go through.
Well, I retired just under 5 years ago, and John, I had a slight background in writing. I began writing as a unit publicist in the film industry in New York. And then as an academic, I wrote textbooks and workbooks and things like that. I thought I would just roll right out of bed that first day of retirement and start cranking out the great American novel. I had no concept of fiction writing. And the best thing that I did, and I would offer this as advice to anyone who is interested in their later years in writing fiction or memoir, historical fiction, is to ally yourself with another group of writers. Find writers in your community, get to know them. I joined a wonderful group here in Albuquerque called Southwest Writers, and that was the single best thing that I did. I had a lot to learn. I met people who could teach me, who could support me. I took courses. I joined critique groups. And it was a long journey, not always a smooth one. But if you go into it with the idea that you're in this for the long haul and that it's going to be a learning experience first and then an experience of artistic expression after that, I think you can do it. The fact that I did it, I think, is encouraging to other authors. I don't have any special gifts, but I worked very, very hard, and I took advice from people. I wasn't afraid to accept criticism, and then I learned the skills, the tools along the way, backstory, story arc, the grammar, the active voice, passive voice, all of those rudimentary aspects of writing fiction came to me along the way. If I had to recommend one book to people who are beginning that journey, I would say the best one is The Writer's Journey, which is a book that kind of shows you how all of the great stories of classical literature and even the Disney movies are structured in a certain way that helps you write it better and helps you develop your characters and the plot and provide a satisfying reading or viewing experience for the audience. So I would say take a look at The Writer's Journey and then read. When you're not writing, read. And that's, I read all of Raymond Chandler every 2 years or so. Because I love his work so much. I read his entire canon every 2 years. I read a lot of Donald Westlake and Robert Parker and Tony Hillerman. Those are the kinds of examples that can inspire you and also help you see how it's done well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's some authors that I'm just kind of getting myself involved in that I never really even knew until I kind of got into this business. Excuse me. Wow, that just kind of broke right on the radio there. But it happens. It's a long show, and I'm drinking a Diet Coke here. So
hey.
And I just kind of find and discover these things. So when you started getting into this genre, I'm sure that now you are discovering authors and people
absolutely.
That you never knew really existed, and now you're able
absolutely.
To meet them.
Absolutely. Right, and I would say, Raymond Chandler, everybody knows. Robert Parker, everybody knows. Donald Westlake, who also wrote as Richard Stark, was new to me and an absolute revelation, just in his kind of noir style and his humor. This guy could do it all. And as a former academic, I tend to be kind of a windbag, so I needed to learn how to pare my prose down and my dialogue, my narration, and he's a classic example of the guy who doesn't have one extra word on the page. That's something that I needed to see that. Raymond Chandler, for me, he's perfection. When I read him, I'll come to a paragraph and I'll stop at the end of the paragraph and just kind of let out a breath and say, my God, every word in that paragraph was perfect, and it was the exactly right word for it. I mean, just, you know, when you're in the presence of a master like that, you just got to sit back and tip your hat, you know?
Yeah, oh,
but
absolutely.
That's part of it. As I work with other writers, they suggest writers to me. Joe Bedell's the one who told me about Donald Westlake, and I'm always grateful to Joe for that. And the more writers you're with, the richer your own mix becomes in terms of your reading background, you know.
Now, I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author Robert Cadera. You can go to bobcaderabooks.com. That's KIDERABooks.com for information, of course, on Red Gold. And then moving forward, anything that you're going to have going on in the Gabe McKinney series, because, you know, we're all waiting for book number two. Now,
well, I'm working
your publisher,
hard on it.
Now, this is your publisher speaking. As your publisher, we're all very much waiting for book number two. Now, when the one thing is that as a debut writer, everybody has struggles. No one's perfect out of the gate. Stephen King, Dean Koontz, Hemingway, nobody's perfect out of the gate. They all have their problems and things that they have to work on. So what's the thing when you go back for Red Gold and now you're going to go into book two? The one, I guess, not really the weakness, but the one thing that you think that you want to kind of emphasize maybe a little bit moving forward with the next book that you're going to really focus on.
Right. That's a great question. I think the greatest task I had in writing Red Gold, along with learning the mechanics of good writing, was to find a voice. And I think as a beginning writer, I and many others tend to imitate. And so a lot of the stuff I wrote initially didn't sound like me. It sounded like an amalgam of some of the writers I mentioned here. And it took me a while to get to the point where I could cut out the things that really didn't contribute to the story or the character. Learning how to accept that kind of deep editing is not easy. And developing a voice is something that has to kind of germinate and marinate. It's not something you pull out of a hat. So as I was writing Red Gold, and it took me a good 3 years, I got to a point where the voice emerged, my style and my voice emerged kind of organically. And I think that was the real accomplishment that I achieved, in addition to telling what I think is a pretty darn good story. What I want to do now with the second book, and this has come much easier, now that I have that voice, I want to be true to it and develop my characters and go a little bit deeper into Gabe's backstory and his childhood and give him another one or two members of his ensemble cast, so to speak, that add some depth to the story. So what I've found in my second book is maintaining the voice and the character, the central character from my first book, putting him in a new and even more threatening setting, and bringing more of his own backstory into the plot, while at the same time, you know, not losing that distinctive voice and style that I'm trying to develop.
Gotcha. Yeah, and see, what is great is that it's the question of you're able to realize kinds of the things that you're going to work on, and you have that idea of this is the things that I want to focus on. And I think a lot of young authors, I don't think they truly maybe get that concept. I think they just kind of throw things out there. They're scared about editing. They're scared about people, you know, telling them what's wrong about their book. But the thing is that I think it's all learning and education. And I think the more that you learn as you go through this process, and we have a very tough editor here in Suspense Publishing, you know about
indeed.
That. And so, but once you start getting that, but I think that hopefully it makes you to be a better writer and find yourself quicker. And I think that makes for a lot
absolutely.
Better
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it gives you confidence. The more you learn, the better you write. The harder you work, the better you write. The more you're open to criticism, I think, the better you write. And the closer you get to your characters, the more easily they come out on the page. I know that there's a saying that all writing is autobiographical and that there's got to be something of you on that page, and that certainly is true. But also you have to respect your characters. I was told very early on at a Southwest Writers meeting, one of their speakers got up and talked about, oh, well, once I start writing, then the characters start talking to me. And I, you know, I listen to what they say, and they take me through the story. I thought to myself, you know, come on, man, that doesn't really happen. But in fact, when you get inside your story and inside your characters, they are a part of you, and they're inside you. And so when you write from the inside out that way, your characters are real. You hear them speaking their own dialogue. And there's a kind of a flow to it, John. I don't know how to describe it in a better word than that. It's a flow. It's you and the story and your characters and your own style all as one. And when you can get into that place, writing is an exhilarating experience.
Yeah, it can, and you start finding out a lot about yourself, I think, when you
absolutely
start writing.
Absolutely, yes. And I couldn't write what I do now if I'd started 30 years ago. I wasn't self-aware enough and savvy enough to appreciate some of what I'm getting from myself in this process of writing.
Now, is there one scene or maybe one line in the book that you kind of look back and said, that kind of captures the essence of what I put down on paper? Can you pick something out like that?
Oh, my. That's an interesting one. Well, you know, they say you got to grab the reader right at the beginning. And, you know, you have to, when you're writing a mystery, you need to give the reader sufficient information, but you also have to play fair with them. So when my book starts, I believe the sentence goes something like this. I knelt by my wife's grave as I had every day for the past year. Well, right away, I'm telling my readers, this is not going to be a lighthearted romp through the garden, okay? You're listening to a man who has profound pain and is struggling,
right?
Okay? And the last sentence in my book, as two other people are lowered into the ground in their caskets, Gabe is standing by the gravesite, and he said he's looking at this and thinking of himself and all that has happened, and his last line is, how can it be that I feel so reborn? Okay, and so here's your character who has started in despair and who has experienced pain and despair and death and every trial that you can imagine, and as his friends are being buried, yet he's able to feel reborn. So that's how Red Gold works. It's a story of a man picking himself up, overcoming terrible challenges, rediscovering his fighting spirit, and learning as he acquires, you know, as he thinks he acquires his goal, that the real gold is not something material, but it's the love that he found along the way.
That's very in depth.
Well, you know, that's the essence of the story, and I think I had to get to the point where I understood, where I could just pare it down like that and keep that that kind of tenet in my mind as I wrote, and especially as I edited. So that's now my next book. What's that? Well, thank you.
Taught you well. Hopefully he's not listening, because now his head's just going to go real big.
I got to say, Joe has been a profound influence on me. He is one of the most generous.
Oh my God,
kind,
Joe! Don't
and,
listen. Turn it off, Joe. Turn off the series.
It's. It's his turn. I don't know if it's his turn to pay for dinner now or mine. You know, being able to cut it down to something that's clear and focused as you write, and to have that that framework in your head is something that I've been able to develop. My second book, Get Lost, the tagline presented itself to me as I was writing the first pages, and it helped me put the whole thing together. And the tagline is, "What do you do when the dead come back and your loved ones disappear?" All right. So that's the underlying theme of the book. And when I had that in my head, God, it was fun.
Yeah.
The first book.
Well, we got
about.
Keep going.
I said the first book was tough. The second one came easy. It's like giving birth, I guess. Maybe our female listeners identify that first baby is an experience, but if you have another one, hopefully it's not quite as painful.
Yeah, but the pain's still real.
Yes. You got to have pain, John. You got to have pain to have growth, right? Okay.
And you will when you send this in and the editor gets it over to you and it's super back and you're like, I didn't think it was that freaking. I don't know.
I've already I've been buying extra bandages every week. All right, I'm ready.
Yep. By the God.
Bring it
on. We got about a minute left, so I want to give you the last minute, Stu, to tell everybody how they can connect with you.
Well, okay. I have a website. You mentioned it, BobCaderaBooks.com. You can also reach it if you dial in McKennaMystery.com, McKennaMystery.com, Mystery.com. I'm on Facebook. Just go to check on Bob Cadera. It's K-I-D-E-R-A. You can look me up there. I am on LinkedIn, but I can't figure out what the hell LinkedIn is all about. All right.
Either am I.
What is it? I keep accepting the invitations, but I don't know what it's all adding up to. I do not do Twitter. I don't do Twitter, as you can probably gather. I'm not a man of 140 characters by nature. anyway, I will be sitting down after I get off the phone with you now and getting back to work. I work every day, 7 days a week. A good writer never rests, unless they're out selling their books.
Yes, you know, and a good writer never dies. They just become a classic.
And I will also, you know, one other thing that I mentioned, I will be around. I'm doing some book signings at Treasure House Books here in Albuquerque. I will be at Left Coast Crime 2016 in Phoenix in February. I'll be at the Hillerman Conference in Santa Fe this November, and I'll be at BoucherCon in Toronto in 2017. So
nice.
I'm mingling.
Yeah, here. Toronto might be a good – we might go to that BoucherCon in Toronto. We have some friends up there, and it's a city that we love. So we might actually go
great.
Up to that BoucherCon and see that one.
That's great. Well, I will certainly look forward to, talking to you over a good table full of barbecue. And
we'll do that as we go see the Blue Jays play.
I was just going to say that's in October. If
it'll
the Blue Jays make the postseason.
No, because, only if the Dodgers are playing them in the World Series will I go.
Well, or the Mets. Come on, give me some credit.
Well, okay,
the Mets
I'll give you some Met love. I know.
All right.
You guys still hate
God,
us.
Do I need that? Thank you,
but
John.
But you hate us since 1988. So you know I get.
Oh, you know what? I hate the Dodgers since 1958. I grew up in Milwaukee, rooting for the Braves, and every year I was a kid, the Dodgers would beat the Braves. You know, Dodgers would finish first. These were Brooklyn Dodgers, and the Milwaukee Braves would finish second. And then finally in 57-58, we got it. And then in 59, Larry Sherry. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
We don't. Larry Sherry. May he burn in hell. All right?
he came up
as a rookie and beat the Braves in the playoff game.
Well, we got to go.
You can tell I'm not a guy
so
who holds a grudge, right?
Yeah, I know. Well, you have a good one. We got to roll. And we are out
okay,
of here.
John,
so Bob,
it's great talking to you.
Thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for listening. We really appreciate you being here. Again, we will not be back. Check the schedule for about another 4 weeks as we hit the road. And check us out at suspenseradionetwork.com for everything we got going on. So until next time, everybody, keep on reading. Don't forget, though, Beyond the Cover will be here
on Monday, and that will be my absolute last show for a month. So, see you later.